This is the Photography Podcast on photography.ca, episode number 52, interview with Kevin Kubota for September 14, 2008. Hey there, photo lovers, and welcome to the 52nd Photography Podcast on photography.ca. My name is Marco, and as always, we're coming to you from Montreal, Quebec, Canada, in Parc La Fontaine, and today is September 14, 2008. For today's podcast, we actually did an interview with Kevin Kubota, and some photographers might know Kevin because he developed some really wicked actions. But we're going to talk a little bit about what actions are, and we're going to talk a little bit about Kevin's style and the way he shoots, and hopefully people can, you know, gain some insight from it. But before we actually get into the interview, as always, I like to thank people for their comments. I'd like to thank Susan of Tomorrow's Treasures for her comment on our last podcast where we talked about cleaning lenses. And it's actually very interesting because I was away a week ago and I was in British Columbia, and lo and behold, I stuck a wide angle lens onto my Canon 30D and I wanted to take some shots of rushing water at sunset time in Tofino. So I rolled up my pants, got right in the friggin' water and started taking shots. This is the salt water because it's the Pacific Ocean. Thought I was really cool getting within inches of the water. And lo and behold, a monster wave overtook me and soaked my camera. So, you know, so we talked about salt water being bad and stuff. Well, I had my camera soaked with salt water. I was in Tofino. Camera stores were closed and, you know, not the biggest selection in Tofino. It's a really small town. So what I did was I just took regular water, just as I suggested last podcast, and cleaned the camera, all the lenses, all the gear as best I could, dried it with a fan. You know, a few days later after I got home, then I cleaned the whole camera body with Kodak lens cleaning solution. And the gear seems to work really well. So, you know, a little bit of practical advice from my own experience. Get the salt water off as fast as you can and then clean the body and the lenses really, really well, because nothing wreaks havoc like salt water on a camera body. But I survived. And at the end of the day, you have to take risk, you know, no guts, no glory. So even though like a wave soaked my camera, I got some great shots out of it, actually. And I'm going to post some on the blog and possibly the forums on photography.ca so you can look out for them. But again, you know, you got to take the risk. You know, you don't always want to be so protective of your gear. You know, the gear is meant to be used. At the end of the day, I was more worried about the card than the actual camera. You know, I'm not a rich person, but the shots that I take are like my babies, and some of them I really love. So I was actually more concerned about the card and the data rather than the gear. But luckily, everything was saved, and it's all good. It's all good. I'd also like to thank a lot of people from our forum for, you know, posting quite a few times. Actually, the forum is becoming busier. It's still a smallish forum, but it's intimate. And I actually really, really love the people that we have on board. And I absolutely encourage new people to post and say hi and become part of the community. It really is a warm community. And especially for critiques and stuff like that, you really can gain a lot of insight. And it's funny, even the people that joined just a few weeks ago, it's unbelievable how much they've learned. And you know, they've posted their pictures for critiques, and now they feel more at ease to critique other pictures. And we always try and do it in a gentle and constructive way. So if you want some feedback, you know, please just post. We talk about all other kinds of things too, plugins and alternative photography, you know, everything to do with photography. So I really do encourage more people to join, more people to post. I'm on almost every single day, and you know, it's my pleasure to meet new people. So anywho, I'd like to thank P.S. Love, Joe Mez, Natalie Young, Nekin, BHVJ Kumar, Rhett, Sweet Oblivion, Scale Speeder, Mindforge, Bear, Lem, Seal Hunter, Paula Lynn, Wayne, Raijo, Fire 209, Dwayne Oaks, True Arts Photography, Bund, or is that Bundy? Easy Pickings and Disrupt Studios for leaving quite a few comments off the bulletin board. Usually when new people join the forum and leave a few comments, I mention them on future podcasts. There you go, so you can get a little bit of recognition if you do post a few times, and you know, it's really, really, really appreciated. We started some assignments a few months back in our forum, so every month now we give two assignments, and it really kind of gives people motivation to put on their thinking caps and shoot something, you know, a little more more creative or something according to a topic. So we actually have some really good, interesting shots for severe manipulation. That's our latest assignment, and that's about to change. It's about to change to portraits, but I highly recommend you check out the assignments and maybe just, you know, try and post, get into it. It'll be a lot of fun. So now let's actually get into the interview with Kevin Kubota, and I'll have more information at the end of the podcast, but the interview is about 25 minutes long, so let's get right into it now.
So I'd like to welcome a special guest today to our podcast. It's Kevin Kubota. And Kevin Kubota is a photographer. Most people may know Kevin or have heard about Kevin from his actions, and we'll talk about what those are a little bit later. But I also wanted to mention that Kevin is a fine art photographer. He's also a wedding photographer. He's quite a well-known wedding photographer, and we thought we could learn a little bit from him today. So welcome to our podcast, Kevin.
Thanks, Marco. I'm glad to be here.
Excellent. So I guess, you know, I'd start off with a conventional question. Could you maybe tell us a little bit about yourself, how long you've been doing photography, maybe what your specialties are, if they're more than what I just summarized, and maybe just a little bit about your gear for a couple of minutes?
Sure. Let's see, I started back in high school, really. My dad was a photographer, although not professional, but a really great amateur photographer, and he had his own darkroom, and I sort of got fascinated by it, watching him as I was growing up. And then I got into it in high school and started learning darkroom techniques and developing my own film, and sort of kept it as a hobby for many years and went through other different career iterations like fashion design, which most people don't know that that was my first official career, and that didn't last very long. And I was fortunate enough to get out of that business, and then I found myself kind of wandering around wondering what I was going to do that was more creative, that was more satisfying creatively. And then it sort of fell into my lap that my roommate at the time wanted to have some pictures taken to give to her boyfriend, a female roommate. And my wife knows all about this, by the way.
Good.
It's cool. It was her friend that set me up.
Yeah.
So I did these pictures for this roommate, and they came out really well, considering the situation. So then her friend asked for pictures, and then her friend's friend asked for pictures, and so on. And that's kind of how I got decided I was going to do that for a living. And I started, this is when I was living in Los Angeles. Then I started to hook up with actors and models in Los Angeles who needed portfolios and headshots. And then after I eventually met people who were shooting weddings and kind of got fascinated by that and really got into weddings when I had my own wedding photographed, which was, oh my God, now I'm going to put myself on the spot. 16 years ago, just about.
That's good enough for us.
Yeah, so hopefully my wife's not listening to this one. And so then I got really fascinated in weddings. And for some reason, most people were at the time kind of shunning weddings, or commercial photographers who I was associating with were looking down on weddings as sort of like what you did if you couldn't do anything else in photography.
Right.
But I really loved it. I thought it was just really, I loved the adrenaline rush. I loved working under pressure, and I loved to be able to be treated more like a fashion shoot. And so I kind of approached it a little different than most of the wedding photographers at the time, and that seemed to work. So that's kind of how my wedding business got going. And so that's been my primary focus ever since, has really been the weddings, although I do portraits and commercial work as well and fine art work on the side. And so it's just grown ever since. And we moved to Bend about 11 years ago, Oregon. That actually, interesting enough, I thought it was going to be the downfall of my business because I was moving from this great resource of a town of Los Angeles where I had clients all over the place and to a little tiny, what I thought was a little hillbilly town in the middle of nowhere. But I loved it here. It was so beautiful. I had to move here. But the business continued to grow ever since then. It's actually been one of the best moves we've ever made.
That's great to hear. Can you talk to us a little bit about the gear that you use?
Sure. I use, as far as on the photography side, I use Nikon, as it's actually pronounced, gear. And I've been using that ever since the very first Nikon Digital D1 camera, and back in 1999 when that came out. Although I was shooting digital prior to that for a couple years, with other Kodak and then some other point-and-shoot digitals, experimenting with those, even on a professional level, trying to get that to work. But I really got excited when the D1 came out, so I've been using the Nikon digital cameras ever since. And then as far as the post-processing, I'm using a Mac. We have all Macs in our studio, and I work on a desktop and a laptop, and I'm using, of course, Photoshop and Adobe Lightroom to process my images.
So you are absolutely 100% not using film cameras anymore?
No, it's actually, the film is the four-letter F word in our studio. We haven't touched it for, it's been almost 10 years, really.
Wow. And it's interesting because, you know, we, you know, on our site, we're mostly leaning toward the digital world because that's just where it is. But every once in a while, we talk about, you know, film and the comparison between film and digital photography, which
Right. It
kind of leads me into like my next question where, you know, for people getting started, you know, how do you start? How do you start when, like, you're coming from a film background? A lot of people still do. You know, they haven't picked up their digital camera yet. They've learned on the site that a point-and-shoot digital is not the way to go, that you kind of off with a DSLR. But then it's all confusing. You know, you get the camera, you get the post-processing after that, you get issues with color balance. Like, and I know you give lectures and things like this, so you're a good person to ask. How do you get people to start? What advice do you give them when they're just starting out?
Yeah, that's a good question because it is a little intimidating. I think, you know, the first piece of advice for anybody who's just trying to improve their photography, and this applies to those transitioning to digital, is to shoot more. And that's, you know, first and foremost, you shoot more, you get better, and you practice more, you get better, and you work your digital images more, and you'll get better and more comfortable and faster with them. So that'd be the first step. But I think it's kind of unfair because we started comparing digital cameras. Most people had digital point and shoots, which up until really not too long ago were not very good quality. I mean, they were good. They're great for little 4x6 snapshots, but people were kind of comparing that to what they were getting with their film cameras, and that probably wasn't a good comparison. But as soon as they step up to a good digital SLR, things really change completely. And the quality, in my opinion, has surpassed film as far as resolving power and noise, being noise or grain free. You could compare them now pretty nicely from the high-end digital cameras to the film cameras. And so people who prefer film, it's fine. It's really just a look, I think, that they're accustomed to or that they appreciate from film. There's just a certain look that film has, which has its quality. It's great. But we sort of moved years ago. I sort of finally let go of that and said, you know, I'm not going to compare digital to film anymore. I need to look at digital for what it is because this is the future. You know, you can barely even buy film. So, you know, I knew it was on its way out. So I said, I'm going to embrace digital. I'm going to make the most of digital and stop comparing it to film. And as soon as I let go of that mindset and just said, okay, this is what I'm going to use. It's digital. I'm going to make the most of it. Then all kinds of new doors and new ideas started opening up to me. And that's kind of where I got started with the actions, which I'll mention later maybe. But that's really why I developed those, because I saw all this opportunity with digital that wasn't there really with film. So that's kind of how I look at digital nowadays. But getting started really is a matter of, I think, starting with small little jobs, like mini jobs. What I recommend my workshop people do is they take a small job, treat it like an actual working professional job. Maybe it's just 50 pictures or 25 pictures, and then run it through the workflow system, whatever system it is you adopt. And there's a lot of tutorials out there. There's information on the web. There's people that have done it before. But find out, get a system, and that's important. I think most people try to just figure it out as they go, and they waste a lot of time because there are so many different ways to do it, and not all of them are the most efficient. So really, there are resources out there, and people just need to adopt a system that's already tried and true and practice that a few times with this small job, and then it becomes like second nature. And you can actually whip through it pretty quick. I'm actually amazed at what I can do, even compared to film, and how quickly I can do it with my images. It's pretty amazing these days.
And just so people know, we're going to put a couple of those resources in the show notes so that people won't have to start from scratch.
Right, yeah.
And I guess, like, it also is going to lead me to my next question. Like, once you do get started, I think people always want to know, or they want to gauge, how long they should be post-processing an image. I mean, back when I used to do darkroom work, I was quite a meticulous darkroom printer. And I would often spend really like 4 or 5 hours, and I'd get maybe one or two prints that I was satisfied with.
Right.
And now that I've gone to like Photoshop and things like that, you could even spend more time than that because there's so many, you know, options. There's so many, you know, things you can do to each image. You could turn it black and white, put a border, make it glow. There's all these things to do. I guess from someone that's been doing this for quite a while, how long do you yourself spend post-processing an image?
Well, that's a, you probably laugh compared to what you were just talking about, but from a commercial, or I would say not commercial, but a working studio point of view, this is different than a fine art photographer point of view. where, you know, our time really is money. What I teach in my workshops is that you should be able to fully work an image, make it look custom, make it look exactly the way you want in Photoshop within 3 to 4 minutes. And if you're spending much more than that, then it's not going to be profitable. So all the techniques that I teach and that I use are designed to get me that final image in 3 to 4 minutes. Sometimes I may maybe spend 5-6 minutes on an image if I have to do major retouching, head swapping, cloning, and that sort of thing. But really, it shouldn't take more than 5 minutes per image. Now, on the flip side, if you're doing fine artwork, that could go on, like you said, 4 hours if you just want to keep experimenting, and that's kind of up to you. But really, if you know what you want, it shouldn't take you more than 10 or 15 minutes to really work a nice image. But a lot of the fun of it, really, for me, is experimenting, because we have so many options, like you said, and there's nothing wrong with spending time trying different effects, black and white, different color looks, and compositing, and spending whatever time you feel you need to get exactly what you're looking for. But obviously with daily wedding work and portrait work, you can't spend that much time, because it'll never pay back when you spend 4 hours on one image.
No, of course. And I'm glad, like, we're actually bringing this up. There is a difference between fine artwork and wedding work. And, you know, like at a wedding, as you well know, you're shooting minimum, I don't know, 400 to 2,000 plus shots. No way on God's green earth are you spending more than a couple of minutes on each one, if at all. You're batch processing and things like this.
Yeah.
But for fine art, you're right. We have like all the time in the world kind of thing, and we just sit there with our one image and fiddle, and It's different. But I guess that's how we learn. That's how we experiment. But it's good to know that if people are doing corporate work or commercial work, that really they can get their work done in 5 to 6 minutes. If they don't have your experience, maybe, you know, add 1 or 2 minutes, but not more than that, I would imagine, especially if you're doing many shots.
Yeah, and that should be definitely a goal. You know, that's kind of a way people can gauge if they're taking much more than 5 minutes per image, then they definitely need to increase their Photoshop skills or tools or whatever they're using, because it really shouldn't, once you're even, you know, somewhat proficient, take more than 5 minutes per image to really just get a nice image, a really good image.
I don't want you to give away too many of your secrets here, but what are some common mistakes that people waste all kinds of time doing? I mean, you obviously have a nice molded and terse workflow that, you know, you put forth in your Photoshops, and you must see certain types of mistakes that, like, newbies are just doing over and over and over. What are some of the common ones, if you don't mind?
Yeah, I'll tell you actually a very simple one that anybody on any level can do to speed up their workflow, and that's learning shortcuts, learning the hotkeys in Photoshop, because just about every function has a hotkey, or you can assign a hotkey or create your own hotkey. And by mean hotkey is, you know, Command 5 or function F5. And also using things to repeat your things that you do. Like I use a keypad that has my favorite actions assigned to it, and I assign them to buttons on my keyboard, so I don't have to scroll through menus to find the actions that I want to use. So little shortcuts like that, learning to use the shortcuts is an amazing time saver. And whenever I do workshops, I'm surprised at how many people are still hunting and pecking through menus, and it might take them, you know, 30 seconds to just find a tool or something that they're looking for, rather than, you know, one press of a button and then it's applied. And that they actually spend more time looking for things than they actually spend doing things on their images sometimes. So I really encourage people at whatever level they're at to first start learning shortcuts to whatever they're doing, and then they can increase their actual skills as well, which are very important.
And there's so many basic ones, you know, just one off the top of my head is like the brackets tool. You know, instead of making the brush size larger by going into the menu and selecting and making it larger, you just use the brackets, you know, the open brackets or the closed brackets.
Yep.
And that saves all kinds of time. So if you're doing an image in 5 to 6 minutes because you have your workflow nice and tight, if you're wasting time looking for, you know, how to increase your brush size, and I guess it's not a waste of time, you know, until you know how to do it, you know, like once you know how to do it, it's cool. But if you're doing steps like that, you know, 5-6 times per image, then you're right. It adds 2.5, 3 minutes, 4 minutes per image.
Yeah. One little tip too, along that brackets, that's a good one that you brought up. Another shortcut that I teach people, or suggest to people rather, is to take their mouse, and the mouse control panel for most computers allows you to program the buttons on your mouse. And one of my favorite shortcuts is I program the scroll wheel on my mouse to actually type the left bracket when I roll it forward and type the right bracket when I roll the wheel back, only when I'm in Photoshop. And then I programmed the scroll wheel button when I press the button to type the letter B, which is a shortcut for the brush tool. And so that enables me to quickly just press the button, gets the brush for me, and then roll the wheel forward and back to change the brush size on the fly. And that's a huge time saver when I'm painting on layer masks, or I'm trying to outline something, or I use layer masks a lot in my Photoshop work. So that's I couldn't even estimate how many hours that saved me over the years just by programming my scroll wheel to type change the brush size for me.
And it's another tip, because it all adds up, right? I mean, if you have to look at through the file menu and that takes long, or you press the brackets and even that takes maybe 3 seconds, but if you have it down to 1 second and you're doing many images and you're doing all these repetitive tasks, it's all a time saver, you know?
Yeah.
Which is what we're all about. And that's going to lead me into the next part of the interview, where we're going to talk a little bit about actions. And I don't want to get too in-depth in it, because I'm actually going to cover a podcast only on actions. But for those people that don't know, I mean, I know, but you're the master, why don't you just give people a really quick definition of what actions are in Photoshop?
Sure. Actions are very similar to plugins for Photoshop, where they will create an effect or do something to your image for you quickly. Although actions are recordings that you can do yourself, or anybody can do in Photoshop, that you record steps to take an image from point A to point B. And people can create actions that do very, very complex things and then provide them to other people who can just load them on their computer, and then they can basically press play and it runs the action and you get the same effect on another image. So the beauty of actions is that once you've created this really cool look, or you've experimented for this 4 hours, like you said, and you finally come up with this great look, you're like, wow, I love that. It took me 4 hours to figure it out. I don't even know how I did it. But if I had recorded that into an action, then I could just open the next image, hit play, and within seconds, I've got the 4 or 5 hours worth of work on the next image. And that's where actions are so wonderfully great time savers that I really can't imagine anything else actually in my entire digital history that's benefited my business more than using actions, really. So, which is why I started to create them and sell them to my workshop people, because I knew it was something that was much more value than what they were costing the people.
And just to add maybe 30 more seconds into it, just so people know, again, you could use actions for the simplest tasks. So let's say you want to just resize an image. You want to turn 20 images, 20 color images, black and white, and they're 10 megs, and you want to turn them into 100K files. So all of those steps are repetitive steps that you're going to do 20 times. By recording one action, it's a sequence of events, and then all you have to do is press the play button within the action palette in Photoshop, and it runs all those steps automatically for you. And as Kevin is suggesting, and he mentioned, Kevin has created a bunch of actions that do quite a lot more than that. And, you know, they tend to give people glows, and they tend to, increase the saturation in certain parts of the image. You can really do almost anything. So how did you learn how to create these, Kevin? Are you a programmer? Where did you learn to create these from scratch?
It's actually interesting. I started, you know, with Photoshop quite a while ago, when I started my digital photography, probably 15 years ago or so. I started to really get into Photoshop, and as soon as I discovered actions, I realized this was cool. This is the way it needed to go. So I really started dabbling with it and figuring them out long ago. And then when I started teaching Photoshop workshops, I would teach people how to then do all these looks that I did on my images, and I would teach them how to do it manually, because my philosophy at the time was, well, you know, teach them how to do it and they can figure it out themselves. People want to do everything manually, and they want to know, they want to have all this Photoshop knowledge. Well, then after a few workshops, I realized people really, for the most part, didn't want to know everything about Photoshop like I did. I guess I was a kind of a freak of nature, because I wanted to know everything about Photoshop, every menu, every tool. But most people really didn't. They said, you know, I just want to shoot. I want to come here. I want to make my images look great as quick as I can and get back out and start shooting and working with the people. And so I said, well, you know, well, I have these actions that I use, that I actually use to run on my images, but I thought you guys would want to know, you know, in depth how to create these looks yourselves. And most people said, no, just sell us the actions. We'll just buy the actions. We don't care how you did it. So that's kind of how I was born, is that I was kind of pushed to start selling my actions because people saw them and they saw what I was doing and they wanted to replicate that. And so that's kind of where it was born, and from my workshops. And from that point on, people were much more interested in just getting the actions than actually learning Photoshop itself.
Right. And when someone uses one of your actions, you know, this is a topic that has come up a little bit on our forum. You know, you have an image, not you, but someone has an image. It's a fairly bad image. They run, you know, a filter in Photoshop, and it turns that image into art. I guess a similar thing can happen when someone uses one of your actions. So Is using actions cheating? I'm sure you've had that question before even. How do you go about answering a question like that?
Yeah, that's a good question. And in a sense, it is cheating. But there's nothing wrong with cheating when time is money. When you're a professional and you're doing this to get paid, sure, I'm going to cheat. I'm going to use whatever means possible to get a beautiful image to my client. And it means the more I cheat, the more money I make. And in that sense, I don't consider anything. I think it's smart business. You know, it's just like saying, are you going to do your taxes with a calculator by hand? You know, or using an abacus. I'm going to do my taxes myself using an abacus because it's the traditional longhand way to do it. Or am I going to give it to an accountant, or am I going to throw it into a computer software and boom, spit out my results in 5 minutes? Or I wish taxes took only that long. But I think when it comes to business, it's whatever gets you the result in the quickest amount of time, as long as it's giving you the quality that you want, is the smartest way to go. Now, if you're talking on the other side of this, again, fine art side, the flip side, I still believe that whatever, as long as you have the vision, I think sometimes people do rely on it as kind of a crutch, as you say, where they take a bad image and make it decent. But really, I think if you look at those images, if it wasn't a good image to begin with, if it didn't have the composition, the subject matter, a moment or impact of some sort, it's not going to be a great image just by running, no matter what kind of actions or you run on it. So it may take a bad image and make it acceptable, but it's not going to make a great image out of a bad image. I really don't. I haven't seen anything really in my history that's taken a really terrible image that would be a throwaway and made it fantastic.
Right, right.
So I think as long as we keep that in mind and realize that this is just a tool, you know, just like all of the great photographers, you know, if we look at Ansel Adams and the time he spent in the darkroom to get the results that he wanted and that we know of his work, he definitely is not a straight film shooter. He's a manipulator, or was a manipulator. I believe that if he had tools to get him to his final result faster than he did, he would have taken them as well. And I think most photographers are not going to torture themselves and say, well, I could spend an hour and a half doing this the hard way or 3 minutes doing it the easy way. You're going to pick the shorter way. As long as, again, you're in control and you're knowing what you want and you're saying, this is what I want, this is the look I want, I can either take the long way or the short way, but this is what I want. And I think that's important, that the photographer's vision is guiding it more so than just randomness, which I guess is not so bad also. You can get some great things just from random application of action sometimes.
No, I mean, it's fun to play. I think personally, I more side with what you said just previous to that, where the intent of the photographer is important there. And and like we said 2 minutes ago, more often than not, crap in, crap out, you know.
Yeah.
but like, as long as you know you want to have a glow and there's an action that's going to give you a glow, for me, that's not so much cheating. For me, it's really cheating when you don't know what the heck you want. You press a lot of buttons, you get 30 results, and you choose one that had nothing to do with your original vision. I think for, I think for me, that's where the cheating comes in more.
Yeah. I guess you could look at it that way, and I wouldn't argue that for sure. That's some would consider that cheating. Some would consider it random art, I guess, or spontaneous art. I don't know. Depending on how you look at it.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, like, once you know what you're doing, and once you've studied actions in general or your own actions, it's a tool. It's a tool. It's like a red filter on a lens to make a dark sky. It's a tool.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for that info, Kevin. I'd like to give you a chance to tell people, you know, where to find you if they want more information about you.
Well, there's our KubotaImageTools.com is our website. That's KUBOTA, Image Tools. And there's all kinds of information about our workshops, which we do in locally here in Oregon, as well as around the country and also out of the country, like Italy. We have an Italy workshop coming up in a couple of months.
Nice.
That's a more of a creative fine art workshop. It's not so much a hardcore workflow workshop like the ones we do here. And then we also have all of our products, our actions, our several volumes of Photoshop actions. We have tutorials on workflow with Lightroom. And then we also have a forum that has a lot of just general free helpful information, tutorials, free downloadable actions there. And there's all kinds of other educational things on the site and our forum as well as on the store.
And again, I'm going to put some links in the show notes so people don't have to remember this. You could just go to the blog and take down the links from the show notes. So I'd like to very much thank you, Kevin, for sharing some of your knowledge with us. You are one of the digital pioneers, so it's a real treat to hear from someone that's been doing this longer than most of us.
Great. Well, thank you. I appreciate being on.
Thanks so much, Kevin.
So I'd like to thank Kevin Kubota very much for allowing me to do that interview with him. So gracious with his time and giving us quite a few tips. There's actually going to be some resources from Kevin's interview where we're going to talk about workflow in the show notes. So you can check out those links and see if your workflow is pretty good and how to streamline your workflow. I have another future podcast coming out in probably about 2 weeks or 3 weeks where I'm going to talk about actions, actually. And we're going to hear about Kevin again because he created some of these fantastic actions. And I'm going to talk about them and other actions in depth in a couple of weeks. If you like this podcast and you want to get it regularly, the best way to get it is just subscribe in iTunes at the front of the blog, photography.ca/blog. Just download iTunes for free. Click the link that says subscribe in iTunes. Done. You can also subscribe in Google Reader, which again is a one-click button off the front page of the blog, or any other podcatcher of choice or blog reader of choice. You can comment directly on the blog, photography.ca/blog. You can send emails at photography.ca@gmail.com. And of course, you could add your suggestions or what have you in the forums. Just make your way to the forums on photography.ca. If you wanted to review the podcast in iTunes or give it a couple of stars, that would be, greatly appreciated. iTunes is still the way most people are finding the podcast, and my goal is to grow it. Share and learn, share and learn. The more people we have on board, the more people we have posting and sharing, the more we learn. So if you're able to take a second and review the podcast, you're doing the community a really good favor. So thanks so much in advance. In terms of future podcasts, we have a lot of really good suggestions lately, actually. So there's one coming up on actions. There's one going to be coming up on how to market yourself to art galleries. There's one on group photos. There's one on smoke, how to photograph smoke. So I'm actually going to have to work harder. And I'm going to try and cover all these in podcasts relatively soon. If I don't get to them, I'm going to answer them in blog posts. But my goal is to do podcasts on each and every one, but it's only so many hours in a day. But I'm on it. I'm on it. And I'm also far behind on an HDR podcast. Oh my gosh. I'm going to try and keep putting out as much work as I can, as fast as I can, and hope that speed is enough. If by chance people do need answers to questions really, really quickly, sometimes it takes me 2 weeks to get to a podcast. If you need super quick answers, you can just send me an email, photography.ca@gmail.com. If I can answer a question quickly, I will. Of course, you can post that question on the forum, and then you have more than just myself answering the question, and you can get various points of view as well. But if you're not in a rush, I'll get to each and every one. But if you're in a rush, just let me know by email or post in the forum, and you'll get more answers more quickly. Thanks for listening, everyone. Get out there. Keep on shooting. Fall is coming. Leaves are changing. All kinds of good things are happening out there. Do something you never did before. Take a photo of something green, orange, blue, something pointy. Take a photograph of a circle or a sphere. Make your job to do something unusual, something that you wouldn't normally do. Get your thinking cap on. And as always, just keep on shooting. Bye for now, everyone.